If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my countryman, you're walking on right beside me. Just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the right beside me. Yeah, walking on the right beside me. Running down real life, if you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You run down my country, man. You walking on the right beside me. Yeah, walking on the right beside me. Running down with life by fighting and falling down deep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. That's the name of this program. I'm your host, Paul Fromm, with more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. I deal mostly with racial and free speech issues, with a particular Canadian point of view. And first story I'm going to look at today, it's kind of a setback for parents, decent parents, Christian parents, and it's a big win for the LGBTQs, that's the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and of course there are a few more letters that got tossed in as well, but not to go through the whole alphabet. So school district approves sex ed curriculum that teaches third graders about anal sex. Now that, there's a real breakthrough, isn't it? The person who sent this to me made the rather obvious comment that we really are living through an era of Sodom and Gomorrah. We've seen this scenario play out countless times before. A forward-looking school district announces plans to implement a radical sex ed curriculum and concerned parents mount a protest. This is actually in Texas. But in related sex ed program in California, actually, sexually explicit includes content on fisting, blood play, oral sex, and more. This time, however, there was a wrinkle. It wasn't only worried parents who showed up outside the headquarters of the Austin, Texas Independent School District to make their feelings known. Members of an advocacy group called Informed Parents of Austin, which champions LGBTQ rights, were also in attendance and tried to shout the concerned parents down. Carol Ayala, director of the group Concerned Parents of Texas, which opposes the changes, told reporters, "The curriculum encourages minor children to engage in vaginal, oral, and anal sexual activity through the comprehensive sex ed program they're voting on. In the end, the LGBTQ supporters won. The board voted unanimously this past Tuesday to approve the curriculum. However, it's not yet known whether the the Austin board will follow California's lead. The Golden State decreed that parents cannot opt their children out of its equally explicit new LGBTQ sex ed classes. So that was last year in 2018. This is, I like to say, it's very much like Weimar. Sodom and Gomorrah is a long time ago in the Bible. Weimar, of course, in Germany in the 1920s, an era of wild sexual perversity or diversity, communist mayhem, anarchism, and in the end, Weimar ended, and let us hope that the same thing will happen in the era that we now find ourselves in, that it too will end. Kind of good news from Portland, Oregon. Portland, Oregon is one of the probably one of the most liberal cities and one of the most crazy cities in America. And despite the fact that it's overwhelmingly white. There've been a number of vicious attacks by Antifa on white nationalists in Portland, and this one ended up in the courts, and for once, some degree of justice was done. A baton attack during the June protests in downtown Portland lands a man in prison for nearly 6 years. A 24-year-old man who hit another man over the head with a baton in June during the dueling downtown Portland demonstrations was sentenced yesterday to nearly 6 years in prison. Gage Halopowski pleaded guilty to second-degree assault in connection with the June 29th attack on Adam Kelly outside the Nines Hotel along Southwest Morrison Street. Halopowski was identified as one of several masked black-clothed demonstrators seen on video hitting and pepper-spraying Kelly after he appeared to come to the aid of another man who'd been attacked during the protests. Kelly, a right-wing protester at the demonstration, wrote on Facebook at the time that the blows to his head left him suffering a concussion and needing 25 staples to close the wounds. I mean, this is a very severe beating. Multnomah County Deputy District Attorney Melissa Marrero said Halopowski hitting Kelly in the back of the head with an expandable baton was completely unexplainable, completely unavoidable, and didn't need to happen. She said Kelly and Halopowski both were lucky that Kelly survived his injuries. Defense Attorney Edward Kroll said Halopowski made a real terrible decision and that Kelly didn't deserve what happened to him, but the attorney believed the agreed-upon 70-month prison sentence was one of the harshest sentences I've seen for someone with no criminal record and his young age. Well, he's 24, he's not exactly 15. Noel cited the Measure 11 charges that Halopowski faced and the attack being caught on video as leaving the 24-year-old with few options other than taking the plea deal. But yeah, I mean, he was caught dead-handed. There wasn't a question of identification or even self-defense. I mean, this was pure, naked, all-out aggression. Marrero, the prosecuting attorney, disagreed with Kroll's assertions, saying she felt the charges and sentence were appropriate based on the severity of Kelly's injuries and Halopowski's strike. She said the first-degree assault, which carries a potential 90-month sentence, and riot charges were initially considered in the case. There are more people, apparently, are going to go on trial for that assault. There was not, and as so often happens with Antifa, it wasn't even just one person. Here's an interesting commentary from a very informed Texas congressman from the 1st District, Louis Gohmert. This is his comments on the impeachment hearings. The Democrats' attempted coup will push this country to the brink of a civil war. On the House floor Thursday, Representative Louie Gohmert, a Republican from Texas, said the way House Democrats were running the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump was about to push this country to a civil war. Gohmert said, "Never in the history of this country have we had such gross unfairness that one party would push armed guards with guns to prevent the duly authorized people from being able to hear the witnesses and see for themselves." And then, "Oh, we hear from this resolution today, we're going to send you the deep depositions after we get through doctoring and looking at and editing the transcripts. We'll send those to you so you have the evidence we need." That's not the kind of evidence that a coup should be based on. If we're going to have what they're trying to legalize as a coup, we ought to have a right to see those witnesses. And he continued, "You see, they want it to be a one-sided, non-due process sham court. It's about to push this country to a civil war if they were to get their wishes. And if there's one thing I don't want to see in my lifetime, I don't want to ever have participation in, it's a civil war." Some historian, I don't remember who, said guns are only involved in the last phase of a civil war. What's going on here is not to protect the Constitution. It's not protected to protect the institutions. It's not to protect this little experiment in self-government. What it has done is to put it all at risk. And what it is primarily doing is the result of angry, bitter Democrats who simply cannot accept that they lost the 2016 election. Donald Trump was never to have been elected. This was just utterly outside their ken. Here is an example of the absolute madness of Canada's what is legally called the Gladue decision, but is generally referred to as the Native Discount. And what it means is that in sentencing, Native, which include Indians, Eskimos, and Métis, those are the mixed race people, mixed Indian and white, are to be given special consideration at sentencing, or essentially a lesser sentence, depending on the circumstances. Why? Well, the Supreme Court in the Gladue decision, which goes back about a decade, decided that Natives deserve special consideration because of a history of colonialism, racism, etc., etc., etc. Now, every judge considers convicted person's background in sentencing. There may be, in some cases, reasons to cut the individual a bit of slack. Perhaps a very poor upbringing, and other circumstances in life that perhaps modify or diminish the degree of responsibility. They should never be used, though, as a reason to completely let a person who's done something seriously wrong, particularly something violent, let them take a walk. The Supreme Court, thoroughly in the clutches of cultural Marxists, excuse me, bought into racial victimology when it issued the Gladue decision, and said, "Well, Natives faced a history of colonialism." Well, indeed. Europeans came to Canada and colonized it. Much of it was empty, not all of it. In most cases, treaties were made with local Indians, and gradually over the several centuries, an accommodation was reached. Many Natives adopted Western ways, not all did, but many did, And many got educations and or job skills and did well. Some did not. Why that history should have anything to do with individual criminality? And most of the criminal acts are actually criminal acts of violence and are personal. Usually aided and abetted by alcohol or drugs. One native stabs, slashes, shoots, and either injures or kills another. Now, how do you blame white colonialism for that? Does a native, before he gets blind drunk and before he starts shooting or stabbing another, say, "I'm doing this because Jacques Cartier landed in Quebec in 1534. No, this is complete nonsense. But nevertheless, okay. That's all background to this story. And I'm going. This is from the National Post. The British Columbia Court of Appeal has rebuked Jody Wilson-Raybould, she's the former Justice Minister, for shortchanging an accused money launderer's Indigenous heritage by agreeing when she was Justice Minister to extradite him to the United States. Now, it must be pointed out that Judy Wilson-Raybould was not only the Minister of Justice, but she was an outspoken Native Indian spokesman, and in many ways strongly biased in favor of Aboriginals in dealings with the government. Now, apparently, though, not in this case. Now, that's what makes this decision by the British Columbia Court of Appeals even more bouncing off the wall absurd. The court ordered Ottawa to reconsider her decision. Now, there's a new justice minister. Ironically, the first Indigenous justice minister failed to consider the history of colonialism and the damage that Glenn Harley Scheck's children will suffer if he's handed over for trial on numerous sophisticated drug-related offenses. Now, that's the accused, Glenn Harley Scheck. Now, so the knock against the previous justice minister in ordering him extradited to the United States, where he's wanted. Were two. Number one, she didn't consider the history of colonialism on Glenn Harley. Well, what did colonialism have to do with his decision to take numerous steps to launder money? I mean, there's no connection. You might just as well make a connection with who won the Stanley Cup last year. Also, she failed to take into consideration the damage it will do to his children if he's handed over for trial. Well, that may indeed be true, that his children will miss their father, and that's very sad. But that could be said of any accused criminal. It also, of course, presumes that he will be convicted in a trial in the United States and sent to jail, which is also highly speculative. But it's true, of course, the children will be impacted. But it's not the Minister of Justice's fault. It's the accused's fault. But anyway, we trudge on. Two judges said it would shock the conscience or be unjust or oppressive to extradite an indigenous man, separating him from his four indigenous children and perpetuating the systemic destruction of the indigenous families and communities. So it would be unjust to extradite him to face trial in the States because it would separate him from his children. But that would be true of any accused who has children. So he's supposed to get a special walk because he's an Indian? Well, that's kind of this whacked up system. And believe me, it's It is discriminatory, but it's discriminatory and anti-white. It was a 2-1 decision, and the dissenting judge said, it was Mary Saunders, maintained that extradition is a political, not a legal decision. To set aside the minister's decision in these circumstances is, in my view, to improperly interfere with her decision. Well, okay. So, but she's the dissent. The ruling by the majority, written by Justice Susan Griffin, supported by Justice Bruce Butler, highlighted the huge disparity in sentences between the two countries. In Canada, Sheck faces between 2 and 4 years in prison. In the U.S., between 19 and 27. Well, yeah, but if the crimes were committed in the United States, the Americans have a right to seek his extradition. And yes, compared to Canada, he may face hard time. But that is not a reason to simply rip up the extradition treaty. Or, I mean, I should say, refuse to implement it. He's been in custody pending a final decision in the case. And the decision of the majority, they wrote, the minister did not mention the impact of separating Mr. Sheck's children from their father in light of their shared indigenous heritage and the legacy of residential schools, and in light of the much longer separation that would occur if he were convicted and sentenced in the United States versus Canada, Griffin wrote. This is an overriding flaw in her analysis. Hopefully this will be appealed to a higher court. But, this could be argued for anybody facing extradition or trial that they're being separated from their family. Yes, agreed. It's a sad thing. It's an undesirable thing. But you know, if you can't do the crime, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. Accused of being a money broker connected to drug dealers, Sheck allegedly moved more than $7 million in roughly 24 transactions between 2007 and 2012 among Canada, the United States, and the Dominican Republic. So we're talking about large sums of money. This guy is a player, not some poor Indian who did one bad thing once. Griffin noted that Sheck was convicted in February 2012 for possession of a loaded prohibited weapon, and prosecution in Canada was not a realistic option. Born in B.C., Sheck graduated from high school and studied wood products technology at college. The charges related to his conduct between the ages of 26 and 31. Again, he's not a child. These are not youthful, one or two youthful misdeeds or missteps. These are serious crimes committed over a period of time as an adult. The court said he now operates a company that provides wastewater treatment and works with his father as an electrical apprentice. Okay. Sheck has 4 children, indigenous children, ranging in age from 5 to 15. The mother of his 3 older children has sporadic involvement in their lives because of substance abuse. You know, we're looking at what is all too often the typical dysfunction and functional a native family, criminality involved, and substance abuse and neglect. But that's not the court's fault. He was ordered to extradited on May 28th, 2018, before Wilson Rabel was shuffled out of cabinet. So that's over a year ago. So this is a judicial review of that decision. The minister's consideration of Mr. Sheck's indigenous status did not inform her analysis of his personal family circumstances and his children's best interests, Griffin explained. Well, this is actually not even a sentence. This is an extradition matter. As important as the children might be, they shouldn't be a consideration as to whether he gets extradited to face a trial in the United States. Nowhere did she consider the impact on them as indigenous children who bear the legacy of government-sponsored separation of indigenous parents and children, of having their only indigenous parent separated from them for potentially decades longer if you were prosecuted in the United States. That may all be true, but that should not be a consideration. And once again, the Court of Appeal, BC Court of Appeal, is playing fast and loose with history. Under the residential school system, some Native children were sent for 9 or 10 months of the year, separated from their parents, to a residential school for education. Many white children were also sent by their parents to boarding schools, if they were reasonably well off, and the children were separated. Hard on children? Probably. But just because that was the history, shouldn't prevent the government from extraditing Mr. Scheck to the United States. The impact on Mr. Scheck and his indigenous children of the Canadian history of separating indigenous children and parents, and the resultant destruction of indigenous communities, which in some ways may have contributed to Mr. Scheck's alleged criminality, were important factors in informing the minister's view of whether surrender was unjust or oppressive. Notice that the Court of Appeal has already made a decision that perhaps the residential schools, to which Mr. Scheck never attended, may have led him into criminality. This is not only the pernicious Native discount, but it also, ironically, offers Natives an excuse for criminality or a justification. Well, and also, obviously, an enticement. I'll explain why. Natives know that they will get a discount at sentencing. They will receive a less serious penalty than a white person doing the same thing, simply on the basis of their race. I mean, ironically, this is discriminatory treatment, but it discriminates against whites. So the Native knows that if he commits a crime and is caught, his sentence will be less than a white person's. That actually is an inducement to commit crime, ironically. Here is from my own city of Hamilton. They're on a big anti-racist kick these days. Hate in Hamilton breaks your heart, says city manager Janet Smith. After 5 months into her dream job as Hamilton's city manager, Janet Smith says she says the most surprising issue she's had to deal with is the rise of hate incidents. Oh, really? A city that has severe poverty, a lot of homeless people, a lot of human wreckage, but hate, the rise of hate incidents. Well, when you see what the incidents are, this is all a media drama. Quote, I know other municipalities are going through the same thing, but it just came at me, said Smith, speaking to the Hamilton Chamber of Commerce. annual breakfast. Smith, who worked in Peel Region for 30 years before coming to Hamilton, says, the diversity and inclusion issue is highly complex, and despite the initial steps taken by council, more needs to be done. During her presentation, she called on chamber members to boost their own diversity numbers among employees, saying it makes good sense, as a diverse and inclusive workplace means a more creative, innovative, and engaged workforce. Well, let's be very clear about what terms mean. When you hear about diversity, it doesn't include you. If you're white, they don't want more of you. And when they talk about inclusion, sounds very good. Inclusive, that means we're all part of the team, right? Well, no, inclusion doesn't include you if you're white. They don't want you if you're for your values. They don't want you. In fact, if your company is embracing diversity, they want fewer of you, and they probably don't want you, your kids. So she says, she's urging companies to boost their diversity. That means, be quite blunt about it, hire more non-whites. She goes on about some other things as well. Oh, yes. The city will be holding a forum in January to discuss racism in Hamilton as part of the city's anti-hate strategy. The Hamilton Anti-Racism Resource Center survey results on lived experiences of racism were released on Tuesday. Well, then there's more on the story. That's the city manager's part of it. But there's another story in the same issue of the paper, and that was the October 31st issue. The city is poised to give the failed Hamilton Anti-Racism Resource Center a fresh start of making it meaningful, viable, and most importantly, effective. So these are make work projects for social justice warriors, paid for by the taxpayer, incidentally. The center is a 3-year pilot project jointly funded by the city, McMaster University, and the Hamilton Center for Civic Inclusion. It was temporarily shut down in February to be recessed because it just wasn't doing anything. Oh yes, I kind of got a laugh at about this Hamilton Center for Civic Inclusion. The Hamilton Center for Civic Inclusion is anything but inclusion. In fact, they lobbied quite strenuously against my being given 5 minutes to appear as a public delegation to be critical of the city of Hamilton's tasking its staff to come up with ways to prevent protests on public property by so-called hate groups and religious fanatics. In other words, to prevent free speech. Well, anyway, I never did get a chance to make that 5-minute presentation because the city turned me down. And one of the groups that was urging that I not be heard was, guess what? Yep, that's right. The Hamilton Center for Civic Inclusion. So when you hear the word inclusion, you might be tempted to feel a nice warm glow around the heart. That means everybody brought into the game. No, it means exclusion of you, if you're one. Anyway, the center opened in April 2018. Its purpose was to gather information on racism-related information to help inform city council decisions and to fill service gaps. The goal is to eliminate racism in the city. I get very uneasy when taxpayers' money is spent
to eliminate a political point of view. At a public consultation Tuesday night, city staff gave only a partial answer as to why it had failed. Today is not to lay blame for the pause. Marlene D'Amoa, chairman of the city's advisory committee against racism, said. So they can't actually explain why it had kind of gone nowhere. So they took a pause. Jody Koch, city diversity director, added that certain details for the pause couldn't be discussed because of personal and legal implications. It sounds like there's a real story there. But, you know, you want to just say, what's taxpayers' money going for this nonsense anyway? excuse me. City staff spent hours listening to literally thousands of people, I wonder about that, over the summer to get their input. While operating the HARC, that's Hamilton Anti-Racism Resource Center, conducted 17 anti-racism seminars, 46 ethno-racial consultations, and received 75 complaints, mostly in person, and the majority about anti-black racism. The majority of complaints were there to receive emotional support, he said, adding, the high levels of anti-black racism are astounding and will require support and resources to respond strategically and systemically. What does this gobbledygook mean? So the 75 people who came forward, their complaints, the majority were there to receive emotional support. Oh, somebody said something to me. Give me a big old hug. We really are a snowflake nation. among the problems cited in the failure to get this Hamilton Anti-Racism Resource Center moving, among the problems cited was that although the center opened in April, its website did not go up until October. Yeah, and these people are paid. The mind boggles. In the time that HARC has been down, incidents of racism seem to have exploded in the city. Among the latest were clashes at a federal election campaign event at Mohawk College featuring the People's Party of Canada leader Maxime Bernier. He's a populist. While some people were there to demonstrate against racism, members of hate groups like the Proud Boys and an Islamophobic and anti-Semitic organization were spotted in the event. Well, what's the racist incident? The incident, actually, was the violence perpetrated by the 100 or so anti-racists, some of whom punched and shoved at people trying to attend, and three of whom blocked the way of an 81-year-old woman in a walker trying to get into the meeting. Eventually, she did get in. Three of the people involved in that incident, including a Syrian refugee, were charged. But the way this is described here, this is not a racist incident. It was a meeting that the anti-racists didn't even want to allow to happen, even though it involved an elected politician. So the incident seems to be that, or the issue seems to be that some group, members of a group that the far left says is a hate group were spotted there. Oh, wow, that's an incident? Proud Boys and other anti-immigrant groups like the Soldiers of Odin and Yellow Vest have held regular rallies outside the Hamilton City Hall for more than a year. That's their right. Should be their right as citizens to hold a peaceful protest. In another incident this month, anti-Semitic graffiti was scrawled outside the Beth Jacob Synagogue. We're not told exactly what the graffiti is. It's always just labeled, and you're supposed to take their word for it that it is as they say. But assuming that's true. So what? One always has to allow for the fact that the Jews did it to themselves, because that's happened all too often in previous racist incidents that received an awful lot of heavy breathing press. But okay, it may indeed have been some bad element in the community that did such a thing. Is this really a big issue? It's graffiti, for heaven's sakes. Let's get a grip. Anyway, this is the sort of weird stuff. And one of the things I think we should do is whenever there's taxpayers' money involved, we should be jumping up and down saying, no way, Jose. If individuals want to sponsor some anti-racism, this or that, that's their business. It should not be at the taxpayers' expense. Well, this is Paul Frog, and you're on the fighting side of me. I'm going to take a musical break right now. I'd like to play some songs by a man who has quite a family legacy, Hank Williams Jr. Hank's father, of course, was the famous Hank Williams Sr. And Hank Jr. began performing as a very small boy, not long after his father's death. And for probably the first decade or more, he was very much under his father's, part of the family legacy or family tradition. Indeed, that was one of his famous songs, Family Tradition. As he grew, Hank Williams Jr. Developed his own style, always respectful of his father, but his own man, and tradition I would probably call country rock. So here are some songs by Hank Williams Jr.
Damn cold.
side by side across the mountains and the valleys wide. We came to dig muddy and we poured in the flood on the Tennessee mare and the Tennessee stud. Now we got a little baby on the cabin floor, a little horse goes playing around the door. And I love the girl with the golden. Thank you.
it's Hank Williams Jr. This is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. Back with you again next time. I sign off tonight as I always do with the anthem of the real Canada, not the dirge, the Maple Leaf Forever, that anthem which is constantly being rewritten for political correctness. This is the anthem of the real Canada. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave, our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Our fair dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours, which discord can.